Well, it is time now to begin today's reading of the Wall Street Journal for Thursday, the 13th of March, 2025. With today's Wall Street Journal, we say hello to George and Steve.
Thank you, John Shea, and welcome to the Wall Street Journal. It's our great pleasure to read for you today. We'll begin with the What's News column on the far left side of the front page of the journal. These are news briefs, all of which we'll get to as we move through the paper today. Inflation cooled last month, but the latest numbers may offer less comfort to U.S. businesses, consumers, and Fed policymakers than they otherwise would because tariffs threaten to raise some prices in the months ahead. The S&P 500 and NASDAQ rose 0.5 and 1.2% respectively after investors weighed trade skirmishes and the inflation report. The Dow dipped 0.2%. Intel named Lip-Bu Tan as its new chief executive, selecting an outsider to help turn around the beleaguered semiconductor company. LVMH named Frederick Arnault, son of chairman Bernard Arnault, as the new head of Italian fashion house Loro Piana. You want to take note of that, Steve?
I got it.
Zara owner Inditex reported slower sales growth at the start of its fiscal year at a time of growing competition in the fast fashion industry. Who knew there was such a thing? Mm-hmm. Battery maker Northvolt filed for bankruptcy in Sweden after it failed to secure the financial backing needed to continue operating. Cathay Pacific's annual net profit rose slightly, but the airline flagged the potential threat that trade conflicts pose to supply chains. Porsche said it plans to cut thousands of jobs over the coming years as part of an efficiency drive as it warned of a hit to earnings this year. And finally, Roche said it would pay Danish biotech research company Zealand Pharma up to $5.3 billion under an agreement to co-develop a weight loss treatment. Good morning, Steve.
Morning, George. And stocks finished session mostly higher. The S&P 500 and NASDAQ rise amid muted inflation data and loud trade fight. The S&P 500 and NASDAQ rose after investors weighed the latest trade skirmish with Canada and a solid inflation report. Both indexes have been under pressure in recent days, dragged low by global trade tensions and concern about U.S. economic growth. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 0.2% after swinging between gains and losses most of the day. The tech-heavy NASDAQ composite was up 1.2%. The S&P 500 rose 0.5%, reversing earlier losses. Wednesday's report showed that consumer inflation slowed a little in February after January's surprising hot reading. The consumer price index rose 2.8% in the past 12 months, slightly undershooting forecasts. The report was the first monthly inflation reading to fall fully under the new Trump administration, though it doesn't capture the impact of the latest tariffs. Inflation concerns have intensified as President Trump's import levies risk fueling price pressures while also weighing on growth. Resurgent inflation would make it harder for the Federal Reserve to make further cuts to interest rates, even if the economy is slowing. Early Wednesday, the Trump administration's 25% tariffs on all steel and aluminum imports took effect. Canada retaliated, saying it would impose a levy on an additional $20.6 billion in U.S. imported goods. The European Union announced retaliatory tariffs targeting a range of U.S. products, including bourbon whiskey, boats, and motorcycles. Some investors are growing apprehensive that prolonged uncertainty over tariffs could hinder growth and tip the U.S. economy into a recession. Right now, the concern on growth is impacting the markets more than inflation, said Adrian Helfert, chief investment officer of Westwood's alternative and multi-asset portfolios. We could see growth rates drop down to the recessionary territory. Elsewhere, Treasury yields rose above 4.3%. On Tuesday, the 10-year yield settled above 4.28%. European stocks mostly gained. The DAX index in Germany rose more than 1%. The U.S. dollar strengthened slightly after the WSJ dollar index settled Tuesday at the lowest level since November. The Bank of Canada cut its main interest rate by a quarter point to counter trade uncertainty. We're now facing a new crisis, Bank of Canada Governor Tiff Macklem said. On Wednesday, the February reading of the product producer price index, which tracks wholesale cost, is due at 8:30, and the core PPI is seen holding steady from January at 0.3%. And now, before we go back to George, let's move to the stock spotlight column in today's Wall Street Journal. Intel, the semiconductors maker stock, rallied more than 10% in after-hours trading following the company's appointment of a former board member and longtime industry executive as its next chief executive officer. NVIDIA, Advanced Micro Devices, Qualcomm, and Broadcom shares of the chip makers rose after a report indicating Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing had proposed a joint venture to operate Intel's factories. NVIDIA's shares rose 6.4%. Advanced Micro Devices added 4.2%. Broadcom advanced 2.2%, and TSMC's American Depository Receipts were up 3.6%. Novo Nordisk. Shares of Novo Nordisk dropped 4.3% after Roche struck a deal with Zealand Pharma to develop a weight loss treatment. Tesla. The EV maker shares rose 7.6% after CEO Elon Musk pledged to double U.S. production in 2 years. Disappointing sales data and concerns over Musk's role in the Trump administration have hit the stock this year. Alcoa and U.S. Steel shares of Alcoa rose 4%. And those of U.S. Steel climbed 2.7% after 25% tariffs on all imports of steel and aluminum went into effect. Rheinmetall, the German defense company whose shares have surged amid hopes for a European defense spending bonanza, reported a 35% rise in sales last year. The stock rose 9.6%. Adobe, the software company's shares slid more than 4% in after-hours trading despite better-than-expected quarterly results. Harley-Davidson. Its shares fell 5.7% amid news that the EU would impose retaliatory tariffs of 50% on products, including American motorcycles. BMW. Shares were little changed after it told its U.S. dealers it would absorb the added costs of new tariffs on its imports from Mexico. And finally, Brown-Forman. Shares of the Jack Daniels manufacturer fell 5.5% on news that the European Union would move forward with a 50% tariff on American whiskey.
Say it ain't so.
It ain't so. George.
Inflation cools off, but tariffs present a threat. The 2.8 increase in consumer prices last month was lower than expected. It's written by Justin LaHart. Inflation cooled last month, but the latest data might offer less comfort to U.S. businesses, consumers, and Federal Reserve policymakers than it otherwise would, because tariffs are threatening to raise some prices in the months ahead. Consumer prices were up 2.8% in February from a year earlier, the Labor Department reported Wednesday, versus a January gain of 3%. Economists polled by the Wall Street Journal had expected a 2.9% gain. Prices excluding food and energy categories, the so-called core measure that economists watch in an effort to better capture inflation's underlying trend rose 3.1%. That was the lowest year-over-year reading since 2021. It was also lower than the 3.2% economists expected. The European Union and Canada announced on Wednesday retaliatory tariffs against the U.S. in response to the Trump administration imposing 25% tariffs on all steel and aluminum imports. The U.S. tariffs took effect early Wednesday morning. More U.S. tariffs are slated to come. Trump said he plans to impose so-called reciprocal tariffs on April 2nd on any trading partner that charges tariffs or imposes other trade barriers on U.S. products. Stocks jumped at the opening bell but gave back some gains by the close, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average turning lower. Analysts warned that an encouraging inflation report wasn't enough to make up for the tariff uncertainty. Moreover, details of the report suggested that Fed policymakers might not be as relieved by it as investors initially hoped. The cooler-than-expected report was, quote, not as encouraging as it looks, Capital Economics economist Thomas Ryan said. Wall Street is beginning to worry that tariffs, in combination with actions by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, which is not an official government department, by the way, could push the U.S. into a recession. Already, consumers are showing signs of anxiety. Consumer sentiment fell nearly 10% in the University of Michigan's February survey. Consumer spending in January had its largest monthly drop in 4 years. Airline fares dropped a seasonally adjusted 4% in the inflation report. Delta Airlines said on Monday, domestic demand had softened, with Chief Executive Ed Bastian saying on CNBC that in February, consumer spending started to stall. Economists are struggling to keep up with the recent tariff news, but are pushing up their inflation estimates nonetheless. Goldman Sachs economists raised last week their forecast for the Commerce Department's core inflation gauge to 2.9% in the coming fourth quarter from a year earlier. That compared with a previous estimate of 2.4%. But Wednesday's report largely predates President Trump's recent tariff actions, which means the full effect of the new tariffs will be captured only in future reports. The report isn't likely to change the Fed's decision to hold interest rates steady when policymakers meet next week. Steve.
Target beefs up grocery area, brings supply chain in-house, article by Liz Young. Target is looking to take a bigger bite out of the $1.5 trillion U.S. grocery market, in part by bringing its supply chain for fresh and frozen food in-house. The Minneapolis retailer has opened three new food distribution centers over the past 2 years and plans to add another next year in Thornton, Colorado, increasing its grocery logistics network to 9 temperature-controlled facilities nationwide. Target is making the changes to its grocery supply chain as consumers grow more skittish with their discretionary spending and as rivals such as Walmart and Amazon.com expand their food offerings. Target has posted sluggish sales over the past 3 years as high inflation damped customer spending and the retailer disappointed some shoppers with its product selection, anti-theft measures, and pricing. Rick Gomez, chief commercial officer at Target, said the company's new warehouses are meant to help place goods close to stores to keep shelves stocked with the items customers want. While we've made big strides with in-stocks, we know that high in-stocks on average are only part of the equation, Gomez said during an investor meeting earlier this month. There's still an important opportunity for us during peak shopping periods, including Sunday afternoon and weekday evenings, because these are the times where being out of stock on a key item can cost sales on related items or even the entire trip. Target for years relied on grocery wholesalers to stock its fresh food selection. As the retailer's grocery aisles grew over the past decade, Target opted to build out its own logistics network for perishable goods to better forecast demand and plan inventory. Target said it now uses its own food distribution centers to service its stores across the continental U.S., giving the company better end-to-end visibility and helping it make more accurate buying decisions and move faster to keep goods in stock. Customers' tastes are constantly changing, and once they get something they really like, they're going to go back and buy it again, said Rob Hanfield, a supply chain management professor at North Carolina State University. Shocking news on that one.
Shocking.
Target appears to be planning its network to be on top of those trends and be more agile to replenish, he said. Sales in its food and beverage division, which include perishable grocery items as well as snacks, candy, and revenue from Starbucks coffee shops inside some stores, grew to $6.5 billion for the quarter ended February 1st. Which the company said was up by low single digits from a year earlier. Food and beverage sales accounted for about one-fifth of the retail's total quarterly revenue. Target also is working to capitalize on a surge in demand for online grocery shopping. E-commerce grocery sales have grown over the past 5 years as shoppers grew accustomed to placing orders for pickup and delivery during the pandemic. Online grocery sales in the U.S. grew by 31% in February from a year earlier to $10.3 billion, according to consulting firm Brick Meets Click. Target was the ninth largest grocer overall in the U.S. by market share last year, with 2.5%. It was the fifth largest in terms of online sales, behind grocery giants such as Walmart, Amazon, and Kroger, according to data firm Numerator. Walmart, Amazon, and Kroger have been investing in their grocery supply chain as well. Walmart, the country's largest grocer, has about 4,700 stores across the U.S. with locations within 10 miles of 90% of the American population. It has rapidly expanded its online delivery and pickup businesses, in part by filling many orders through its stores rather than at warehouses to speed up fulfillment. Amazon is testing new grocery formats that pull together its various fulfillment networks for its Whole Foods Market premium grocery business and its mass-market Amazon Fresh stores, with the goal of creating one-stop shopping for products ranging from organic produce to Tide detergent. Kroger has been working with technology provider Ocado Group to build automated fulfillment centers around the U.S. to speed up online grocery delivery. George.
CEO frustrations with Trump over trade mount in private. Behind closed doors, business leaders air their concerns about the administration. It's written by Chip Cutter and Lauren Thomas. Washington. How business leaders talk about the Trump administration in private has been markedly different from what they are game to say in public. The dissonance was on full display here this week. Early on Tuesday, dozens of corporate executives and others assembled at a Yale CEO caucus not far from the White House, just as news emerged that the Trump administration planned to potentially double tariffs on steel and aluminum from Canada. Those in the room responded with a mix of groans and shocked laughter. There was universal revulsion against the Trump economic policies, said Jeffrey Sonnenfeld, a professor at the Yale School of Management, who organized the invite-only summit that included corporate bosses such as J.P. Morgan Chase's Jamie Dimon, billionaire Michael Dell, and Pfizer's Albert Bourla. They're also especially horrified about Canada. That sentiment wasn't apparent hours later, when many of the same chief executives from the Yale event attended a question-and-answer session with President Trump at the Business Roundtable. There, the exchange was largely cordial, and executives didn't ask the president any pointed questions about his tariff strategy, according to people with knowledge of the event. Some business leaders have cited the need for a stable approach to policy. Swinging from one extreme to another is not the right policy approach, Chevron Chief Executive Mike Wirth said to an energy conference in Houston on Monday. We've allocated capital that's out there for decades, and so we really need consistent and durable policy. Others have limited their remarks to the costs of tariffs on their industries. Alcoa's boss said steel tariffs would cost thousands of U.S. jobs, while Target's CEO warned that proposed tariffs on Mexico would quickly push up grocery prices. At an Economic Club of Chicago event last month, Walmart CEO Doug McMillon said some consumers were exhibiting signs of economic stress. Yet as the stock market nears correction territory and companies rush to stockpile goods and scramble supply chains, few are complaining openly and directly about the president's trade policy. That is a departure from the public stances CEOs often took during Trump's first term on issues ranging from immigration to climate policy. In an impromptu poll at this Yale event, the CEOs made it clear that things would have to worsen significantly before they publicly criticized the president. Asked how much the stock market would need to decline for them to speak out collectively, 44% said it would have to fall 20%. Another 22% said stocks would have to fall 30% before they would take a stand. Plenty want to say nothing under any circumstances. Responding to the same survey question, nearly a quarter of CEOs said they didn't see it as their role to publicly push back against the administration. On questions about national security, CEOs were more open to critiquing Trump, a Republican. Steve.
Aluminum tariffs to hurt popular Ford F-150. Article by Mike Colias and Bob Tita. America's most popular pickup truck might not be able to outrun President Trump's new tariffs on steel and aluminum. The Ford F-150, the top-selling vehicle in the U.S. and the automaker's main profit engine, is one of the industry's biggest users of aluminum. The Trump administration reinstated early Wednesday a blanket 25% tariff on steel imports and boosted the levy on aluminum made outside the U.S. The tariffs are the latest Trump administration trade barrier that threatens to inflate already high car prices. Together, the metals account for more than half the materials that go into cars, and costs from the tariffs likely will get passed along to car buyers, analysts say. If left in place, they could, on average, inflate the cost of automakers building a car by about $400 a vehicle, according to Barclays Research. The aluminum tax in particular presents a problem for automakers. They are using more of the lightweight metal in cars, but the U.S. has been producing less of it. Most of the high-quality aluminum used in vehicles' outer bodies starts out as imported aluminum, and there are a dwindling number of domestic alternatives. Ford's brawny F-150 and Super Duty pickup trucks, the company's biggest profit generators, are among the most aluminum-intensive vehicles on the market. The company a decade ago converted the trucks to a mostly aluminum exterior, including the hood, doors, and truck bed, to save weight and enhance fuel efficiency. Ford had been working with suppliers to stockpile aluminum materials ahead of the Wednesday deadline. Even though the company gets most of its aluminum sheet from rolling mills in the U.S., those suppliers rely on smelters in Canada to provide much of the aluminum they roll. A Ford spokesman said it would take many years to rewire its supply chain to get more automotive-grade aluminum from the U.S. He declined to comment on the potential effect on prices should the tariffs last. While we are working to find offsets to the added cost, this will be difficult, he said. The metal tariffs are the latest import taxes that Trump has floated, sending the car business scrambling. The administration last week granted a one-month reprieve for 25% tariffs on all imports from Mexico and Canada, which threatens to decimate the bottom lines of car makers and parts suppliers. The president on Tuesday said that he would substantially increase tariffs on cars on April 2nd, which he said would cripple Canada's auto manufacturing sector. Steel accounts for about half of a vehicle's weight, and aluminum makes up about 13%. Auto executives and analysts have said the steel tariffs will be more manageable than the aluminum levies because the companies source most of their steel from U.S. suppliers and have more domestic options. Ford has said it gets 90% of its steel from U.S. sources. Bertrand Rokodo, the global automotive practice leader at consulting firm Ducker Carlisle, said many automakers have fixed-price metals contracts, and any effect on car prices would likely be delayed for a few months as suppliers and car makers negotiate over who will absorb the added costs. At the end of the day, the consumer is going to pay, he said. The auto industry faced price shocks from Trump's 2018 tariffs on metals. The U.S. spot market price for sheet steel reached a decade high within months after the tariffs took effect. General Motors said at the time that the added costs were the main factors behind raising commodity expenses that hit its bottom line by about $1 billion. Ford reported a similar hit in profitability, citing the metals tariffs. The high prices didn't last. Panic buying that started in the run-up to the tariff left many buyers with too much steel, causing lackluster demand, falling prices, and the idling of steel production the following year. The industry's introduction of dozens of electric models in recent years has led to broader use of aluminum as automakers incorporate more lightweight materials to offset the weight of heavy batteries. EV maker Tesla uses aluminum extensively in its cars, including large sections of its vehicle frames. The amount of aluminum in an average U.S. vehicle was on pace to grow by about 30% over the past decade to more than 500 pounds this year, according to a 2023 Ducker Carlisle report. The auto industry is the largest user of aluminum in the U.S., according to industry data. U.S. production of aluminum in smelters, known as primary aluminum, has been declining for decades, leaving the auto industry more reliant on imports, especially from Canada. Canada is the largest supplier of primary aluminum to the U.S., accounting for 75% of the material consumed in the States, according to the Aluminum Association Trade Group. The higher prices from the 2018 tariffs caused steel companies to spend money for new plants, adding several millions of tons of annual production capacity to the U.S. steel market. U.S. aluminum production, on the other hand, shrank in after the 2018 tariff. Aluminum smelters use gobs of electricity, accounting for about 40% of their operating expenses, and rising power costs contributed to their dwindling presence in the U.S., where smelters in operation have shrunk to 4 from 7 5 years ago. Smelters in Canada, meanwhile, have access to low-cost power from hydroelectric generators. George.
Thanks, Steve. And I think I may have found an article that doesn't have the word tariff in it.
Impossible.
We'll find out. Fires deter L.A.'s biggest insurer. State Farm says writing new policies doesn't make any sense at this time. It's written by Kevin T. Duggan. In her pop art decorated office in Beverly Hills, real estate broker Rochelle Mays got an early look at who would control the future of Pacific Palisades. It was 8 days after the wildfires broke out, before Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass had appointed a recovery czar, before rebuilding plans had been drawn. Fire still burned and the air was putrid with the ashes of thousands of torched homes. Even then, the power of California's insurance companies was evident to Mays. Her clients buy and sell mansions in crown jewel neighborhoods where listings bottom out around the single-digit millions. Many pay in cash, but after the Palisades fire, deals in the area kept falling through. One client wanted to go ahead with a seven-figure purchase, risk be damned, even if he had to be self-insured, meaning he would proceed without a policy. "It's in a great area," Mays recalled the client saying. "I'm just willing to take the risk." She thought that was crazy. The question for Los Angeles isn't so much how to rebuild the Palisades, a coastal community of around 21,000 people, but who pays if it burns again? Writing new policies doesn't make any sense at this time, State Farm General, California's largest property insurer, wrote Tuesday to the state insurance commissioner. To shore up its finances, the company is seeking permission for a 22% rate increase for 1.2 million homeowners. The state's fire recovery dilemma was aired at a recent meeting on the third floor of an office building in Oakland, California. Insurance Commissioner Ricardo Lara convened executives from State Farm and Consumer Watchdog, a nonprofit advocacy group. By then, the scale of damage from the January wildfires was estimated at $250 billion. Lara began the meeting by lamenting a state law dating back to the 1980s, known as Proposition 103. The law allows insurance premiums to go up by no more than 6.9% for homeowners without a public hearing. Disastrous wildfires, floods, and earthquakes have followed in the decades since. "I face the task of regulating an insurance market operating under outdated regulations that have not been significantly reformed since the passage of Prop 103 in 1988, Lara said at the meeting. "This outdated regulatory structure has hindered insurers from actively reflecting the true cost of doing business in California. For most homeowners, insurance is the price one pays to not worry about the worst. But California's consumer protections exposed a stark problem. Proposition 103 effectively offset the true cost of living in some of the state's most exclusive and high-risk neighborhoods. If the insurance commission prohibits insurers from charging a certain amount of money, insurance companies will say no, and then you're left with people who self-insure," said Richard Green, chair of the University of Southern California's Lusk Center for Real Estate. The LA recovery plans underway are supposed to help mitigate insurers' concerns, such as requiring fire-resistant building materials and restricting homeowners from planting more flammable shrubs. The proposals have set off political squabbles over residential density, affordability, and a housing shortage. Yet the city's rebuilding plans might not matter much, at least until the state and its insurers decide if risky stretches of California's most desirable real estate are safe enough for human habitation. It's clearly about risks that extend well beyond specific fire zones. It's also about the very basis of insurance, which is spreading the cost of risk, and so it has implications for every single homeowner in California. Steve.
Airlines reduce forecasts amid recession fears. Article by Dean Seal and Connor Hart. Several top airlines cut their guidance over fears that an incoming recession could further erode travel demand after a choppy start to the year. Executives from Delta, American Airlines, and other major carriers warn that demand from consumers, businesses, and government customers has come under pressure in the first quarter. The most common factor? Mounting economic uncertainty. What we're seeing now is a kind of broad softness in the macroeconomy, Southwest Airlines Chief Executive Bob Jordan said at a conference on Tuesday. It's hard to attribute to any one thing. The turbulence marks a turnaround from earlier in the year when several airlines touted better-than-expected results in the fourth quarter, boosted by strong leisure and corporate travel. Since that time, President Trump's economic policies and erratic approach to tariffs have damped consumer confidence and prompted a pullback in discretionary spending. Government travel has also retreated by as much as 50%, according to United Airlines Holdings, as the new administration slashes government jobs and spending. The decline in trends has produced a weak first quarter, which was beset with a number of demand pressures that appear to be transitory. Among them was a mid-air collision of an American Airlines flight and an Army helicopter in January. American said Tuesday that it now expects to lower revenue and a wider adjusted loss in the first quarter, in part because of the crash. An executive for Southwest Airlines said the tragedy suppressed bookings across the industry. Delta saw an immediate pause in corporate travel and bookings, Chief Executive Ed Bastian said. The growth rates that we have been on stalled considerably, Bastian said. Consumer confidence, certainly in air travel, started to wane a little bit as questions of safety came in. Other factors weighing on revenue included wildfires in California early this year and adverse weather in certain parts of the country. Those temporary constraints account for about half of the guidance cuts made this week, Raymond James analyst Savanthi Syth said. The other half stems from broad uncertainties about the economy. She expects the effects to be more muted during the second quarter, which is typically the peak season for flying, but could pack a bigger punch in the second half of the year if demand weakens further. Southwest Jordan said Tuesday that broad weakness is expected to stick around through most of the second quarter before moderating in the back half of the year. His projection came shortly after the Dallas carrier halved its first quarter outlook for revenue per available seat mile, a key indicator of profitability closely followed by investors. Despite the downbeat view, Southwest shares bucked a broader sector decline on Tuesday with a 9% gain after the airline said it would start charging customers for checked bags. The stock fell about 1% on Wednesday. George.
New head of the FTC brings a MAGA mindset to antitrust. It's written by Dave Michaels, Washington. Andrew Ferguson started his legal career with such a conventional antitrust practice, defending companies facing investigations and allegations of anti-competitive conduct, that his parents joked he was a pro-trust lawyer. A decade later, Ferguson's rapid ascendance through Republican circles has put him in charge of the Federal Trade Commission, where he will try to chart a new course for antitrust enforcement, mixing MAGA populism with strains of the GOP's traditional lighter-touch approach to regulation. Ferguson, 38, became chairman of the FTC, which enforces antitrust and consumer protection laws, after his progressive predecessor, Lina Khan, elevated the commission's profile by arguing the nation's largest companies, especially in the tech sector, need to be reined in. The two share more in common than first meets the eye. While Ferguson has been outspoken in criticizing Khan's approach to business as too heavy-handed, he is also part of a GOP wing that shares her suspicions of corporate power, especially as a threat to personal liberty. In his first weeks on the job, Ferguson disappointed Wall Street by announcing that he would maintain Khan's tough merger oversight guidelines, which gave enforcers more leeway to block deals. He also shares her belief that antitrust enforcement should address a broader range of problems than just the classic concerns about consumer prices and the supply of goods. I reject the very narrow view of antitrust that the only two things we need to care about are price and output, Ferguson said in an interview. That isn't what the law says. Still, the similarities only go so far. A former law clerk to Justice Clarence Thomas, Ferguson has brought a distinctly Trumpian bent to the chairman's office. Last month, he launched an inquiry into how social media firms sometimes censored or banned users who questioned COVID-19 vaccines and the fact that Joe Biden won the 2020 election. The government is never the speech police, but we are the market power police, he said. If firms are wielding market power to treat consumers unfairly by driving their ideas out of the marketplace, that's an antitrust problem, and I want to address it. Some of Ferguson's early moves have rattled the agency's bipartisan traditions. He endorsed President Trump's bid for more presidential control over independent agencies such as the FTC, and he feuded with the Democratic commissioner on social media over the need to investigate soaring egg prices. Steve.
Trade deficits are capital surpluses. This article is by Jeremy J. Siegel. The Commerce Department reported a record $918.4 billion U.S. trade deficit in 2024. President Trump believes the trade deficit is harmful to the American economy because it signifies that the U.S. is buying more goods and services from abroad than we are selling, depriving domestic workers of good-paying jobs. But there is a more constructive way to look at a trade deficit. The $918.4 billion deficit reflects an equal $918.4 billion capital surplus. In other words, foreigners are buying $918.4 billion more in U.S. assets, such as stocks, bonds, and real estate, than U.S. citizens are buying in foreign assets. This demand for U.S. assets boosted the value of American stocks and bonds and helped fund the country's growing budget deficit. That explains why the market has declined in response to Mr. Trump's restrictions on trade. A simple example shows the relationship between trade and capital flows. Suppose an American buys a $40,000 Toyota made in Japan. Toyota has three options for what to do with these dollars. It can buy $40,000 worth of U.S. goods or services, in which case there would be no trade deficit. Or, because it expects the American economy to grow, it can invest $40,000 in U.S. capital, say, the S&P 500 index, U.S. government bonds, or American real estate. It can also temporarily invest the funds in short-term, interest-bearing assets, such as treasury bills, commercial paper, or bank deposits, that enhance the lending capabilities of American financial institutions and fund short-term corporate borrowing needs. What if Toyota doesn't want to buy U.S. goods or assets? Then it can sell the dollars on the foreign exchange market. People purchase these dollars either because they want to buy U.S. goods or assets, or because they think the dollar will appreciate in value. But even if these dollars are held for speculation, they are usually invested in short-term interest-bearing assets. And if the dollars flowing abroad are held as physical currency, the U.S. still benefits, since these notes are incorporated into the national debt but accrue no interest, essentially an interest-free loan to the U.S. government. If there were too many dollars flowing abroad, the value of the dollar would sink on the foreign exchange market. That isn't the case today. In fact, demand has been so strong that despite the nearly $1 trillion trade deficit, the value of the dollar has been rising for years. It's important that the U.S. push for fair trade, which is what the Trump administration is doing. But the trade deficit isn't always the product of unfair trade policies. It also emerges because foreigners want to participate in the exceptional opportunities provided by U.S. capital markets. Imposing excessive tariffs to curb the trade deficit stanches foreign demand for U.S. assets, leading to lower stock prices and higher interest rates for U.S. firms and consumers. Mr. Siegel is a professor emeritus of finance at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School and chief economist at Wisdom Tree. George.
From the personal journal section of the journal, the article is, Ozempic is enlisted in the war on aging. It's run by Alex Janin. For decades, scientists have been on the hunt for an anti-aging drug. Now, some say we may have already found it. A fast-growing body of research signals potential health benefits of GLP-1s, the class of diabetes and weight loss drugs known by names like Ozempic, beyond what they were initially approved to treat. That includes age-related conditions like Alzheimer's, osteoarthritis, and certain cancers, and even mortality. Doctors and researchers emphasize the need for larger, more rigorous, long-term studies to confirm their preventive effects are causal, not just correlational. Still, since Ozempic was approved in 2017, thousands of studies have been published examining the effects of GLP-1s. Last year, Wegovy won a new Food and Drug Administration approval to reduce the risk of heart attacks and other cardiovascular events, and Ozempic was recently approved to help kidney disease patients. This accumulating body of research has led longevity clinics to market and prescribe GLP-1s as so-called gerotherapeutics, drugs that can target certain biological hallmarks of aging. Dr. Nir Barzilai, a physician scientist who is president of the Academy for Health and Lifespan Research, reviewed a dozen FDA-approved drugs and drug classes with potential benefits to extend lifespan and so-called health span, or how long people live in good health. GLP-1 is ranked in the top third. Excess weight can trigger chronic low-grade inflammation, which has been linked to increased risk for a host of conditions from heart disease to dementia. Obesity drives aging, said Barzilai. The drugs work in part by suppressing appetite and making users feel fuller faster. Their weight loss effect likely plays a big role in their potential preventative health benefits, health experts say, but it is probably not the whole story. An analysis of a large trial involving adults with heart disease revealed that semaglutide, the active ingredient in Novo Nordisk's Ozempic and Wegovy, provided cardiovascular benefits regardless of participants' initial weight or the amount of weight they lost. This could suggest anti-inflammatory benefits or show that people on these medications often eat healthier foods, not just less food, says John Deanfield, a professor of cardiology at the University of College London, who led the analysis. Part of the longevity issue is not just living longer. It's making sure that you avoid some of these diseases of aging as well, he says, adding that drugs like this will need to be tested for their ability to prolong life expectancy. Researchers at Case Western Reserve University found that among older patients with type 2 diabetes, semaglutide was associated with a 40 to 70% lower risk of an Alzheimer's diagnosis over 3 years than other diabetes medications. Steve.
iRobot warns of continuing operations. Roomba maker begins strategic review as its loss widens in the quarter. Article by Sabella Ogea. iRobot warned investors of a going concern to maintain enough assets to operate and pay its debts. Instead, it has initiated a strategic review of the business. The warning came after the maker of robot vacuums reported a wider loss and lower than expected revenue in the fourth quarter. The Roomba maker said it cut jobs to reduce costs. Shares tumbled 36% on Wednesday, bringing the stock's loss in the year to date to nearly 48%. For the fourth quarter, iRobot posted a net loss of $77.1 million, or $2.52 a share, compared with a loss of $63.6 million, or $2.28 a share for the same period a year earlier. The company reported a 47% drop in revenue in the U.S., a 44% decline in Europe, Middle East, and Africa region, and a 34% slide in Japan. The company had most recently guided for adjusted losses of $1.20 to $1.50 a share and revenue of about $171 million. The company did not provide an outlook for 2025, saying there can be no assurance its product launches will be successful due to consumer demand, competition, macroeconomic conditions, and tariff policies. In January, iRobot had said it expected to grow sales as it introduced new products. Given these uncertainties and implications they may have on the company's financials, there is substantial doubt about the company's ability to continue as a growing concern for a period of at least 12 months, iRobot said in a filing. The company said it is actively engaged in ongoing discussions with its primary lender as the board reviews alternatives for the company. Since it began in 2024, after Amazon.com abandoned its planned $1.7 billion deal to buy the company, iRobot said it has reduced its headcount by more than 50. The board hasn't set a timetable for the conclusion of this review, for which it hired Canaccord Genuity and BOFA Securities as its financial advisors. George.
Intel taps chip sector veteran as CEO amid struggles. It's written by Connor Hart. Intel named Lip-Bu Tan as its new chief executive, selecting a former board member and longtime industry executive to help turn around the beleaguered semiconductor company. Tan, the former CEO of Cadence Design Systems, is joining a one-time industry-leading semiconductor manufacturer that has lost market share and struggled to execute a strategy to keep up with other chip makers. Intel stock rose 13% to $23.28 in after-hours trading Wednesday following Tan's appointment. Shares have lost more than half their value over the past 12 months. Tan, who has more than 20 years of semiconductor and software experience, served on Intel's board for about 2 years before stepping down in August. During his tenure at Cadence, he helped turn around the company, focusing on what Intel said was customer-centered innovation that helped double revenue and send the stock higher. We will work hard to restore Intel's position as a world-class products company and chips foundry, Tan said in a message to employees. That's what this moment demands of us as we remake Intel for the future. Intel led U.S. chip making for decades, but fell from the perch in recent years after a series of malfunct manufacturing missteps and an AI boom that shifted demand away from its central processing chips. Former chief executive Paul Gelsinger was ousted in February after his turnaround effort stalled. NVIDIA has surpassed Intel as the most valuable semiconductor company in the U.S., gaining about $3 trillion in market value since 2021, while Intel has lost $150 billion. Qualcomm and Tesla have explored hiring Intel to produce chips for them, but backed off. Tan will step into the permanent role March 18th. Steve?
And this is the Review and Outlook column, which appears regularly in the Wall Street Journal. Mahmoud Khalil and his green card. The Trump administration's decision to revoke the green card immigration status of anti-Israel activist Mahmoud Khalil is becoming a cause célèbre. For better and maybe worse, Mr. Khalil may deserve deportation. But he also deserves due process, and revoking green cards as a policy would have cost beyond any individual's fate. The latter is what Mr. Trump seems to have in mind. This is the first arrest of many to come, Mr. Trump posted on Truth Social. We will find, apprehend, and deport these terrorist sympathizers from our country, never to return again, he elaborated on X.com. Secretary of State Marco Rubio posted that the administration will be revoking the visas and or green cards of Hamas supporters in America so they can be deported. The deportation of green card holders shouldn't be taken lightly. They are permanent residents who sought legal approval and were vetted through official channels. Millions of people consider the green card a guarantee of secure U.S. residency and build their lives around it. The Khalil case has many green card holders wondering if they could also be grabbed and deported for espousing controversial political views. That's why the facts of this case and a day in court matter. A green card comes with legal obligations, including the disavowal of terrorism. Under 8 U.S.C. 1182, an alien is inadmissible if he or she endorses or espouses terrorist activity or persuades others to endorse or espouse terrorist activity, or is a representative of a political, social, or other group that endorses or espouses terrorist activity. Mr. Khalil seems to have violated that obligation. He belongs to Columbia University's Apartheid Divest, CUAD, and was a lead negotiator during last spring's anti-Israel encampment on the campus. Those protests glorified Hamas. CUAD was also a key player in the school's encampment, which was a Zionist-free zone, a designation that excluded Jews from a large part of campus. In October 2024, CUAD formalized its support for Hamas and again celebrated the October 7, 2023 massacre. In a statement revoking an apology the group had made for the remark of member Kamani James that Zionists don't deserve to live, the group said that apology didn't represent CUAD's values or political lines. The group added, "We support liberation by any means necessary, including armed resistance." Mr. Khalil understood these legal risks. In October 2024, he said, "I am here on a foreign visa. That's why for the past 6 months, I've barely appeared on the media." He told the BBC that Columbia briefly suspended him in April 2024, but quickly reversed itself, which allowed him to retain his student visa. Mr. Khalil is now married to a U.S. citizen, which typically provides a path to citizenship. His wife is also 8 months pregnant, but Mr. Khalil knew what he was doing, and living in a free society means taking responsibility for one's actions. This is where due process comes in. The government is required to provide a specific legal basis for Mr. Khalil's detention and for revoking his green card. In a March 10th letter to Mr. Rubio and other Trump officials, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression wrote that the government must not use immigration enforcement to punish and filter out ideas disfavored by the administration. A federal judge on Wednesday extended his order preventing Mr. Khalil's deportation. And Mr. Khalil is also entitled to a hearing in immigration court. All of this would have been far less fraught if Columbia had taken disciplinary action, including expulsion against protesters who targeted Jewish students, occupied campus buildings, and violated campus rules and civil rights laws. Foreign students would have lost their student visas, facilitating their deportation, and Columbia wouldn't have emboldened groups like CUAD and Students for Justice in Palestine. In that sense, the Trump administration's decision to withhold $400 million in grants and contracts to Columbia for failing to protect Jewish students is important discipline. But the case against Mr. Khalil will depend on the facts of his support for Hamas. President Trump has often said the U.S. needs talented immigrants, and a green card is crucial to the process of becoming a permanent resident and perhaps a citizen. The administration needs to be careful that it is targeting real promoters of terrorism and not breaking the great promise of green card by deporting anyone with controversial political views. George.
Thanks, Steve. Venture investors' IPO hopes diminish. It's written by Yulia Chernova. The stock rout will make it difficult for new issuers to go public, a disappointing development for a venture market in dire need of liquidity. It's a monumental challenge to price an IPO in this kind of a market, where major indexes are actively plummeting and the VIX volatility index is above 25, said Matthew Kennedy, senior strategist at Renaissance Capital, a provider of pre-IPO research and IPO-focused exchange-traded funds. The VIX index, created by the CBOE, measures 30-day expected volatility in the U.S. stock market. The index jumped above 28 early Tuesday, up from about 16 a month ago. This sort of market shock pushes back IPO timelines, Kennedy said. Leading into the year, some investors and founders in the venture market expected improved conditions would finally open the gates for more venture-backed initial public offerings after three slow years. Yet 2025 got off to a sluggish start, and the recent declines in stock values of high-growth tech names are reducing prospects for a turnaround. The market has been reacting to a global trade war and a rising risk of a recession. Companies that pursue IPOs in these conditions would likely need to settle for lower valuations, Kennedy said. Market volatility is keeping companies like Dataiku, it's D-A-T-A-I-K-U, on the sidelines. There's no IPO market currently, said Florian Dataiku, co-founder and chief executive of Dataiku, which provides artificial intelligence software to enterprises. The company was last valued in a private round at $3.7 billion in 2022 and has more than $300 million in annual revenue run rate, the CEO said. He said he is preparing the business to go public in due time. Yet there is no rush. I'm a rather patient person. The market seems too unstable, Dato said. There have been six venture-based IPOs on U.S. stock exchanges this year as of Monday, one more than the total at the same time last year and below the annual average, according to Renaissance. All of the listings in 2025 so far have been venture-backed healthcare companies, including Maze Therapeutics, backed by Third Rock Ventures and others, and Metsera, which counts Arch Venture Partners among its investors. Steve.
Rheinmetall signals booming sales as Europe rearms. Article by Christina Gallardo. Rheinmetall said it expects to grow between 25 and 30% this year and is likely to lift its guidance in coming months to better capture the impact of Europe's plans to rearm. Chief Executive Armin Papperger said Wednesday that following meetings with European leaders and Mark Rutte, Secretary General of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, he estimates European NATO countries could increase their defense spending to a combined nearly $1 trillion, or $1.09 trillion, by 2030. Rheinmetall could capture up to 20 to 25% of this money, he said. Europe has to grow to emancipate itself, he told a call with investors, pointing to threats by the U.S. administration last month to reduce its military presence in Europe if European governments within NATO don't increase their defense spending. If Rheinmetall succeeds in attracting that level of European NATO spending, the German manufacturer could beat even the highest of investor expectations for sales and earnings before interest, taxes, and amortization in the coming 5 years, J.P. Morgan analyst David Perry and Lucy Fitzgerald said. European officials are discussing a package of measures to boost defense spending across the 27-strong bloc, including creating a 150 billion euro loan program backed by EU guarantees and a temporary exemption for EU capitals to boost their military budgets without breaching the bloc's strict financial deficit and debt limits. Some European countries, such as the UK, have already announced boosts to their military budgets, while others, including Germany, Rheinmetall's biggest market, are expected to follow suit. Friedrich Merz, Germany's likely future chancellor, has announced a bill that would exempt military spending from Germany's strict financial rules, a move described by Papperger as very clever. Rheinmetall's chief sought to reassure UN officials' concerns over whether the European defense industry base will be able to absorb a rapid rise in orders, saying that the German company has invested nearly 8 billion euro to build new plants over the past couple of years, make acquisitions, and secure supply chains to cope with soaring demand. We have massively increased our capabilities, our capacities, already, and will continue to do so, he said. An era of rearmament has begun in Europe that will demand a lot from all of us. Rheinmetall, the biggest beneficiary from the war in Ukraine among European defense companies, anticipates its Ukrainian business will contribute 2 billion euro to results this year, with 300 million euro coming from air defense, about 200 million euro from combat vehicles, and 1.5 billion euros from ammunition. Ukraine has asked Rheinmetall to build an ammunition plant in the country with capacity to produce about 15 million rounds over 10 years under a ceasefire scenario, Purpicher said. This would represent a 50 million euro contract that hasn't been accounted for in its current estimates, he added. George.
Thanks, Steve. Battery maker Northvolt seeks bankruptcy protection. It's written by Dominic Chopping. Stockholm, Swedish battery maker Northvolt filed for bankruptcy in Sweden after it failed to secure the financial backing needed to continue operating. A Swedish court-appointed trustee will now oversee the process, including the sale of the business and its assets and the settlement of outstanding obligations. Northvolt has been working through a Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection process since late last year as it tried to restructure its debt after a series of production problems were compounded by competition from China and funding shortfalls, creating a liquidity squeeze. The company said it pursued all available options to negotiate and implement a financial restructuring, but was unable to secure the necessary financial conditions to continue in its current form. Rising capital costs, lower demand, and geopolitical instability with subsequent supply chain disruptions have all added to the challenge in securing a path forward in recent months, it said. Founded by former Tesla executives in 2016, Northvolt had hoped to become a European champion in the region's transition to electric vehicles, offering Western automakers a homegrown alternative to Asian suppliers. By the end of 2023, it had secured about $15 billion of investment, while its order book had swelled to more than $50 billion from customers including BMW, Scania, Volvo Cars, and Volkswagen. Volkswagen and Goldman Sachs were among the company's biggest backers. A period of aggressive expansion saw the company set up a main factory base in northern Sweden and begin work on additional factories in Germany and Canada, as well as a sprawling network of other facilities across Europe. But production problems and delivery delays last year coincided with a dwindling cash pile. The company began slashing jobs before suspending a factory expansion project in Sweden, scrapping plans for another plant in Sweden, and slowing development plans elsewhere. Co-founder and chief executive Peter Carlson stepped down when the company filed for Chapter 11 in the U.S. in November. The company has since sold its battery recycling and raw materials joint venture to Norsk Hydro, while Volvo Car took full control of a battery joint venture. Truck maker Scania also recently agreed to buy Northvolt's heavy industry business. In a statement following Wednesday's bankruptcy filing, labor union IF Metall said it was bolstering its resources near Northvolt's Swedish sites to help support its members. Thanks so much for listening. Please be sure to join us again next week for more editions of the Wall Street Journal. Have a great weekend.